Miami's mayor has a dream for a high-tech city. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Mayor Francis Suarez wants Miami to become a tech hub with new infrastructure and even using cryptocurrency. He'll answer questions about his conversations with the Biden administration, Elon Musk, and using Bitcoin. Also, Cuba has come up with its own vaccine for COVID-19. Some on the island nation think it could become a tool to attract more visitors. And finally,
the body style, whether you were a chonga or not, pretty much determined how you were valued.
An exploration into chonga culture and the aesthetics of excess. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. What if I told you by the year 2025, Miami had become an international tech hub? Major tech companies call the Magic City home. We have a system of underground tunnels to alleviate traffic, and we have the ability to pay taxes in cryptocurrency. For Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, this is the vision. But is Miami ready for a tech revolution, given the challenges posed by the coronavirus pandemic and climate change? Well, Mayor Francis Suarez joins us now to answer those questions. Mayor Suarez, always a pleasure.
Luis, it's always wonderful to be with you.
Thank you so much. And by the way, if you have a question for the mayor, send it to us via email, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or on Facebook or Twitter at WLRNSundial. All right, let's jump right into this, because you have been really busy lately and in the news a lot about your vision for the city and for the future. One of the visions, of course, is to make this into an international tech hub. Lots of parts to that. Let's talk about the recruitment of tech companies. Since you took office in 2018, how many tech companies have moved to Miami?
Oh, wow. It's hard to say how many tech companies have moved to Miami. We have Microsoft, Blackstone, move their tech offices. We have founders like Keith Rebois, Peter Thiel, which were a part of PayPal. We have the Founders Fund that just moved. Those are some of the big names. Obviously, there's a series of people that have moved from the Pompeianos to so many others. Every single day I get messages from people who are telling me they're moving to Miami. It's kind of overwhelming.
How many jobs do you think have been created? Do you have any idea?
It's got to be in the thousands. Blackstone alone was 200, and so I would estimate that by the end of 2021, my guess it would be in the thousands, if not the multiple thousands. And you're talking about jobs that are, usually high paying jobs, so $100,000 jobs and above. So you're talking about an economic impact of millions and millions, if not tens of millions of dollars.
And Do we know if those companies, are they coming here creating jobs or are they just relocating their people?
I think it's a combination of both, Luis. Some of it is, people who are here, and obviously they're trying to recruit from here. And I think some of it is attracting people from other parts. And by the way, some of it is attracting people who were from here but have left and now are coming back. So, I'm 43 now. When I was 20 years old, oftentimes people felt that if you wanted to go to a great university or to a great college, you have to leave Miami. And then many times, in many cases, you wouldn't come back. And I was on an interview earlier today where the commentator was telling me that his daughter just called him and told him that she was moving back from New York, and that it was such a great feeling for him. And he was thanking, And I said, that's the objective. The objective is we want to create a place where our sons and daughters can grow up, can get educated, and can create companies that are transforming how we make decisions, that are transforming our quality of life for the better, and that have an opportunity to provide for themselves and their families.
One of the things, too, I was curious about is this. You're the mayor of Miami, the city of Miami. A lot of people who live outside may not know that's not the whole area. That's not Doral. That's not Coral Gables. That's not Kendall, South Miami. It's that area. Does it matter where they move to if they decide, we want to come to Miami, but we like this area over here by Doral? Does it matter?
It doesn't matter to me. No, it doesn't matter to me. I don't think Miami, and I've often said this, Miami is more than a city. Miami's an idea. If you go to Europe and you live in Fort Lauderdale, or you live in West Palm Beach, even at times, sometimes people will self-describe themselves as, "Oh, I'm from Miami." Miami is the brand. It's what people know as South Florida. So for me, I don't think that this is about creating a particular economy in a certain boundaried area. For me, this is about the fact that our economy today and tomorrow and the next day is going to become more tech-oriented, whether we like it or not. Whether we think politically, and I hear it from both sides of the political spectrums, Republicans and Democrats who have concerns about tech coming to Miami. And for me, it's not a partisan issue. It's about understanding where our economy is and where our economy is going. And if we care about our children, and if we care about our city's future prospects, we're going to create the kind of economy here in Miami that is not just dependent on some of the industries that we've been dependent on traditionally, and will evolve and be and give opportunities for those in our city that may not otherwise have had them.
So I want to go back to something you just said a second ago, that Miami is a brand. So when you're selling this idea, are you selling the brand or are you selling a deal?
No, I think we're selling the brand, and we're selling more. It's not a deal. We're selling, the idea that we need to be diversified as an economy. We've been a construction and hospitality-based economy with basically tourism, which are not necessarily high-paying jobs, even though there's certainly upward mobility in the hospitality industry. It's an industry my wife worked in, and it's a wonderful industry. And construction, we've been a development city. I think we need to make sure that, and finance as well, I think we need to make sure that we're on the cutting edge of industry, because again, I have a six-year-old, actually he just turned seven on Sunday, and I have a two-and-a-half-year-old who's going to be three in April. And, not just for my generation, but for their generation, we need to make sure that we are attracting the kinds of companies that are going to allow them to realize their dreams and their potential.
I want to ask you about what the incentive is. What is it you're selling exactly? And don't say weather. Tell me, what is it that, how do you convince a company to move from San Francisco or California or, and any of these big cities? What's the selling point?
I think there's multiple, and it's really not a hard sell, frankly, at this point. I think some of those cities have unfortunately taken their productive members of their city for granted. They are taxing them way more than what we are, frankly. They have to pay state and local income taxes in those cities, which they don't have to pay here. The cost of living is significantly higher in those cities than it is here. The weather is a part of it, because of technology, now you can live where you want to live as opposed to where you feel like you have to live.
But do we? But Mayor, do we have the tech infrastructure? I mean, because, Silicon Valley has it, but do we have that infrastructure, with all the, to have the universities? First of all, because California has a massive university system. Do we have all of that in place that we could say, this is where you want to be? Because they're going to look for that.
Sure. No, listen, we've been building it for 10 years. I mean, this is something that's been very thoughtfully curated by our community. This is not a Francis Suarez thing. This is something that our community has been doing thoughtfully for 10 years, for the better part of a decade. What happened with the "How can I help" tweet a few months ago was it created an explosive moment where now we're seeing an increase and a growth rate that is sort of J-curve and exponential. But the underpinnings and the conditions needed to grow an ecosystem of this kind, we've been working on them for 10 years with accelerators, with eMERGE, which is the largest tech conference in southern part of the Americas, and now we're working on our school systems, at all levels, K through 12, and also at the university level, because there is, as you said, a maybe a reputational issue. Maybe we haven't communicated or we haven't told our story in the way that we should. For example, one of the things I learned right after the "How can I help" tweet was I created a mayor's technology working group, and I learned from Saifi Shouf, who now is working in my office heading Venture Miami, that FIU graduates the most African American and Hispanic engineers in the country. I didn't know that prior to that moment. So part of it was we weren't telling our story. FIU also has top 20 in the nation for patents. A lot of people didn't know that. So I think part of it is reputational, and there's ways to overcome that.
And there's that, but those are interesting points, and I didn't know either, which means there may be a brand to Miami, but you have to sell that part too. Just real quickly, I want to mention we're talking again with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez discussing his vision to transform Miami into an international tech hub. What would that look like? If you have a question for the mayor, email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. You had a conversation with Elon Musk. First, I want to know who called who, and what can you tell me about that conversation?
So the conversation came together because he and I exchanged tweets basically in the middle of the night regarding building a tunnel in Miami and building tunnels in Miami. And in his tweet, he references a conversation he had with the governor. And then the county mayor, Daniela Levin-Cava, also jumped in on the tweet and said, let's talk. So, you know, there's a confluence of factors that don't often come together, which is you have a governor, a county mayor, and a city mayor all interested in this potential idea. I followed up with the CEO of the company, the Boring Company, called Steve Davis, and then they set up a call for us to call, and I got a call from him just a couple weeks ago.
So, and we had talked about this on the show because Elon Musk talked about building tunnels in Florida. We discussed specifically his tweet, and you know, we talked with Jean-Pierre Bardet. He's a professor of engineering at the University of Miami, and we asked about the idea of a tunnel in Miami, and this is what he said.
We may be at the forefront of sea level rise, but we should not forget that many, many tunnels are going underwater. I mean, an example is the tunnel which connect France and Great Britain.
Yes.
A 50 kilometers long tunnel under the channel. Here, you know, it could be flooded easily. You just have to keep the opening of the tunnel safe from flooding.
All right. Sea level rise. Flooding.
You're absolutely right.
And remember, we're built on a sponge and water. So how do you do it?
Well, the irony of it is it's already been done. It's actually been done not too far away from where I was proposing it. We built a port tunnel, and it was completed, and it hasn't had any issues since it was built. And your professor is 100% correct. They've been done everywhere in the world. And in fact, I'm going up in March up to Las Vegas to see the tunnels that they built in Las Vegas, which, by the way, also has a water table issue like we have. So, you know, a lot of people love to create issues. Very few people actually understand the geology and the engineering that's involved. And I think that's why it's exciting to be able to, when the richest person in the world calls you and says, hey, I have a solution that can save you hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, that's something that you should listen to.
Well, that's an interesting point. I wanted to ask about the money. He's claiming he could do it in 6 months for $30 million. That tunnel you're talking about, though, is up $700 million up. So, I mean, first of all, what proof do we have that he can do it in 6 months at that cost? These things always end up costing more.
Well, do they end up costing more? How many tunnels have you costed out, Lewis?
But, well, look at the one up in Boston. Come on. No. Mayor, seriously, you could look at tunnels. Any construction project,
the most public construction projects, you're right. Most public construction projects do end up usually overrunning, right? That's a very an unfortunate reality with government projects. But in this particular case, I think there's a couple of things that are different. The first is, look, I didn't come up with the price. He's the one that told me he thought he could do it for that amount of money. Now, it wasn't a guaranteed maximum price, which is in construction, you call it a GMP, you know, where you have a hard contract that says, hey, we can do it for this amount. But let's say he's off, and let's say it costs $100 million. It's still worth doing, right? I mean, you're talking about, we priced out that tunnel for $1.3 billion or $1.6 billion, okay, when we studied it at the TPO. So if you can do it for $30, $40, $50, $60 million, I mean, it's a significant savings. You know, so he's already doing it now in Las Vegas, which I'm going to go see. And actually, members from Broward County, the mayor of Fort Lauderdale, the mayor of Boca, and one of the county vice mayors went up there last week. So, you know, you have to have an open mind when it comes to these things. I have absolutely no.
I understand. I understand. I want to move to something else too before I run out of time with you.
Just to mention,
by the way, I lived in Las Vegas, and yes, they have some flooding issues once in a while, but like rarely because it's a desert. It's a different place. But anyway, just want to point that out.
Flooding issues. They have water table issues.
Water table issues, but they're flooding issues occasionally, but it's rare. Let me ask you about this. You also are pushing this idea of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin. So what do you envision exactly? Do you think that we're going to switch completely to cryptocurrency and we're all going to be doing business and getting paid in Bitcoin?
It's impossible to tell what the future holds. I mean, it's hard to tell what's going to happen next week or the week after. But, you know, I think the idea is the following. Number one, you know, giving your employees an opportunity to get paid in a percentage of their dollars in Bitcoin. I don't know if you know this, but the person who is going to make the most money this year in the NFL is a player, not who is the best player. It's a player who decided to take a percentage of their salary in Bitcoin. So, and the reason why I say that is for two reasons. One is it's been done, and it was particularly successful for that person. I'm not saying that every employee is going to want to be paid a certain percentage of their salary in Bitcoin. It's an option that they can exercise or not exercise.
But it's a risk.
Everything is a risk. Taking your money's in dollars is a risk, Lewis. If the dollar tanks because we have a large stimulus, that's a risk too.
It doesn't tank as fast as Bitcoin does.
It doesn't rise as fast as Bitcoin does either. So
okay,
that's the way. That's risk. That's life.
We're talking about taxpayer dollars, though.
We're not talking about taxpayer dollars. We're talking about. What you were talking about was our employees having an opportunity to get paid in Bitcoin. That's their dollars. They can do whatever they want.
Wait. You're talking about employees. You're talking about, you know, city workers.
Yes, city workers.
Okay, taxpayer dollars.
That's their dollars. When you get paid, it's not taxpayer dollars. You get paid, it's your money. So they can take their money and they can put it in whatever form they want. The other one is city residents and taxpayers being able to pay the city in Bitcoin for taxes and fees. That's city. That's our residents' money being converted from Bitcoin to regular dollars and being accepted in our city coffers as regular dollars.
Let me come back to something. Again, city employees. All right, you know their wages. You know, if we're saying we want them to be paid or we're giving them the opportunity to be paid in Bitcoin, it's a bit risky, you know. And I know what you're going to say. You're going to say the dollar's risky, but I'm saying that it's a bit risky because...
It's their decision is what I'm going to say. It's their money. Are you going to tell me what I can and can't do with my money? Of course not. So
okay.
if the employee wants to get paid in Bitcoin, the employee has the opportunity to get paid. If they don't want to get paid in Bitcoin, they don't have to. I'm not saying a bunch of employees will take the option. They may not.
And you know, there are a lot of people who still don't know what Bitcoin or cryptocurrency even is.
Right.
So, I mean,
I presume those people won't want to get paid in Bitcoin.
Are you going to have a campaign to teach people to educate us all on how this works?
One of our commissioners has asked that we put on an educational campaign, and I think that's a wonderful idea. But I'm not pushing anybody to do it. If they want to do it, they're welcome to. If they don't want to do it, they absolutely don't have to. There's no obligation whatsoever to do it. Just like if our employees wanted to get paid in euros or in francs or in any currency, they can opt to do it or not. I mean, it's up to them.
Yeah. All right. Well, how fast do you think, or how soon do you think that would happen? When's the earliest do you think with Bitcoin
it's hard to tell, Lewis. It's hard to tell. We'd have to go to a procurement. It would be done by a third party. So you know, it'll take some time. It's going to take some time for sure.
I know you got to go, but I want to ask you real quickly, just to change subjects. You had the opportunity to speak with President Biden, and I want to switch over real quickly to the pandemic issues. And you spoke with the president. He spoke with a number of mayors, and you asked specifically about, under the last administration, you didn't feel heard, and you didn't feel that in the last, monies from Congress that Miami got enough. What did you hear from that conversation? What do you come away with from talking with the president about this next set of relief money for cities?
Well, two things. One is he has made a concerted effort to involve the mayors and to ask the mayors for input on a variety of things, climate and also and also things like the American Relief Act. So, you know, it was an honor to be invited to the White House as one of four mayors nationally to be invited. And, you know, I thought it was incredible. So we talked about the fact that obviously in the first COVID Relief Act, like I said, you know, publicly at the time, our city only got $15 million and we should have gotten $80 million. And so, you know, that was a major issue because cities that had less than 500,000 residents were arbitrarily cut out. And he agreed. And we talked about a formula to be able to prevent that from happening again, which is to use community development block grant dollars that we get on an annual basis directly from the federal government as a means of distributing the money. And he agreed with that as well. So I was very, you know, sort of pleased with the outcome of the meeting. And the other thing that we talked about, which was vaccines, after the after we spoke, the subsequent week, he opened up a federal vaccination site in Miami-Dade County. So I felt that he listened to our, you know, conversation and acted on it.
And again, Congress may be voting on that relief package either this week or next week. I want to thank my guest, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. This is, I mean, it's an exciting and interesting conversation, and we're gonna continue talking with you about it because we want to see what the future of Miami is going to become. Mayor, as always, thank you
so much, Lewis. Likewise, spirited conversation. Thank you.
Appreciate it. And again, you can always share your ideas. Find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. What does the future of Miami look like? And, you know, what do you think about some of these ideas the mayor is pushing forward? Well, still to come, Cuba is in the final stages of a new vaccine. Would you make the trip to get your shots over there? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. As millions of Floridians are still awaiting their coronavirus vaccine, there may be another option coming available. That would require some travel, though. Cuban scientists are in the final stages of testing the Sovereign 2, a vaccine developed by the Cuban government. Once approved, the country is planning mass development of doses that will be available to both citizens and tourists. Many questions remain about accessibility of the vaccine for those who need it most, its efficacy, and potential cost. Joining us now, the New York Times reporter Natalie Kitroev and WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. Natalie, Tim, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Lewis.
Thank you.
Natalie, I want to start with you. Tell us a little bit about this vaccine that's coming out of Cuba, Sovereign 2. What does the medical community say about it? What do we know?
Well, I mean, you know, the results of the trials haven't yet been published, which is, you know, we should expect to see published results at the end of phase three trials, which are happening next month. It's going to involve 150,000 people between Cuba and Iran, which is also participating in the trial. But the scientists involved have said that the first two phases of trials have shown good and safe results. Keep in mind, the first two phases are not about efficacy. They are about safety and about antibody production. You know, obviously passing those trials and showing a high level of safety is a requirement for heading to phase three. But we're still waiting to find out, but we should know relatively soon.
And how transparent has the Cuban government been with the public, with everybody about this?
You know, they're historically pretty transparent with their vaccines and their vaccine results. They export to over 30 countries vaccines. They make 8 of the 12 vaccines that are administered to children on the island. So they have a good track record. You know, like I said, we don't have any results yet. So we don't have anything to go on. But judging by history, we should expect to get an accounting of just how effective this vaccine is after it completes phase three trials.
Yeah. Tim, this is an interesting part of the story of Cuba, that it actually has a very robust biotech industry that goes back a few decades. Compared to what you see in other industrial nations, though, how would you rank it?
Well, I can only rank it based on my own experience covering it. I remember the first time I visited the top biotech institute there called the Finley Institute back in 1999. It was during a time when Cuba was developing a meningitis vaccine that was so effective that the United States felt compelled to relax the trade embargo against Cuba so that the biopharma corporation SmithKline could enter into a partnership with Cuba to produce and market that meningitis vaccine, which, as I recall, there was a wave of meningitis cases amongst college students in the United States at the time. So there was sort of an urgency to it. And there are other examples like that. And so you can only conclude that Cuba's biotech industry is on an advanced plane, despite the fact that the rest of its economy is so threadbare. And I think that goes to, you know, speaks to the fact that, you know, during the past 60 years of the Cuban Revolution, you know, the two things that they have emphasized perhaps the most is healthcare and education, and particularly healthcare.
So, I mean, from what you know, you have the confidence that they can have a vaccine?
Based, again, on the history of this biopharmaceutical industry in Cuba, and based on you know, examples like the one I just mentioned, the meningitis vaccine that I saw being developed there, you know, 2 decades ago, I think it's not unreasonable to have confidence that this could turn out to be a vaccine that does have you know, sufficient efficacy.
Natalie, the vaccine comes in 3 shots, at least from the reporting you had, and it has to be taken every couple of weeks. What do we know about their ability to produce it? How much they can actually produce?
They say that they expect to be able to produce 100 million doses this year, which would be more than enough to vaccinate you know, their entire population and potentially begin exports. It's unclear whether that is actually the case. And from conversations with scientists on the island, it seems that that would require stopping the vast majority of other, you know, medical production that happens on the island. Plus, it is really difficult for them to get their hands on the materials that they need, partly because of U.S. sanctions, to produce at scale. So there are certainly a lot of challenges to producing quite that many doses in a short period of time. But, you know, they certainly have, they seem optimistic.
Tim, what do we know about the number of COVID-19 cases in Cuba?
Well, they have registered fewer than 50,000 cases, which is not really alarming, but not great compared to the rest of the Caribbean. They've had about 305 deaths from the virus. So it hasn't been on a pandemic level, on an epidemiological level, you know, so disastrous. What has been disastrous for Cuba in terms of the virus is the economic effects, how this has just completely and utterly battered their tourism industry that they depend on so greatly, and how that has affected people like private entrepreneurs, these fledgling private entrepreneurs in Cuba who do depend to a large extent on that tourism traffic that comes through Cuba, particularly American tourism traffic, these cuentapropistas, as they're called, and who are really a focus of United States efforts to reform, you know, the system in Cuba. They've been hurt quite badly.
Again, I'm talking with WLRN Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett and New York Times reporter Natalie Kitroef, Cuban scientists developing their own version of the COVID-19 vaccine, one of 4 set to finish trials this month. You could find Natalie's reporting on our social media and hear more of Tim's Latin America reports this afternoon. Tim, interesting you bring this up, and I wanted to talk about, you know, the economics of this, because one interesting part of Cuba's economy is that it leases out doctors to the world, and this is pretty lucrative for them, right?
Very lucrative, but also comes under a lot of criticism internationally. It's seen as one of Cuba's more cynical efforts to bring in hard currency to the island. You've got about an estimated 50,000 Cuban doctors who are sent all around the world to more than 60, mostly developing countries, to provide medical services. And Cuba is able to bring in about as much as $13 billion a year with this program. That's more than tourism, mining, and even remittances from countries like the U.S. combined bring to Cuba. The criticism comes from the fact that 75 to 80% of the revenues that are generated by these medical services that Cuban doctors provide goes to the Cuban regime, not to the doctors. It's even been called, you know, a form of medical slavery by critics. And the Cuban regime insists that no, this is a very noble service that Cuba provides poor nations around the world. But it really has come under very harsh criticism in recent years.
So, Natalie, some Cuban leaders believe that the vaccine could become an economic boom for them. They might actually be able to bring tourists in because of it. We've seen this in Mexico and Canada, other Latin American countries, Americans going over the border to get cheaper medicine or medical procedures. What does Cuba think they're going to do with this? Do they think they're going to be able to, you know, start a vaccine tourism?
It does seem as though that idea has been floated. The idea of offering the vaccine to tourists presents some logistical, complexities. But, I think the idea is that it could, in many ways, rescue the country from economic ruin. One of the most important of which, of course, is by eradicating or really controlling the spread of the virus on the island itself. If you have a country that is completely free of the virus that is close by, I'm in Mexico where that is a long way away. If Cuba is able to do that within the next year, I think there is some hope that they can bring in tourists and also, export the vaccine to countries that need it and can't get their hand on another option.
Have we seen that with Cuba? Have they, they attract medical tourism for any other purpose?
I think that there is some medical tourism in Cuba, but mostly, the Cubans are lacking for basic medicine. I mean, at this point, pharmacies don't have painkillers on the shelves. It is very difficult for the island to access medicines, again, because of even tighter sanctions put on Cuba by the Trump administration. And so, usually Cubans are asking for folks to bring them medicine. If they are able to attract tourism for the vaccine, be an interesting role reversal there.
Tim, we see a lot of people in Florida struggling to get their vaccine. Do you think that any American, or Cuban American, but any American is going to make the trip to Cuba? Do you think this is something that's appealing?
Well, it might look more appealing now, particularly, as Natalie just pointed out, there was always, a lot of traffic back and forth of this sort of thing between, Miami and Havana, between Cuba and Florida and the United States. And the fact that Biden will be apparently allowing Americans again to make the same sort of volume of travel to Cuba that they were doing before the Trump administration sort of cut it off in many ways. I think that, too, could allow for more of this sort of thing. But then again, I think you have to keep in mind the symbolic nature of that sort of thing. I think the idea of going to Cuba and availing yourself of a vaccine made by this despised communist regime, that would be a troubling prospect, I think, for a lot of exiles. So I think you have to balance those two impulses. So it'll be interesting to see if that sort of thing does play out.
Do you think that because it's a vaccine and it has to be cooled, it has to be kept cool, that there could be a black market for this? The people bringing it back?
I think, yes, given, as I said before, the nature, the two-way flow of goods and things of that nature between the island and this peninsula, yes, I think that's, as with anything else, I think there's a good chance you could see a black market developing that sort of thing.
See, I'm wondering how this is going to work, though, Natalie, because one of the points you brought up is it's three shots over a 6-week period. So what do they expect people to just keep coming back, or that even at one point, I think you brought up that maybe we could take it back with us.
Yeah, that's what one of the scientists told us, that that the possibility, that is being considered is that you get one shot on the island and they send two home for you to administer on your own. As Tim pointed out, there is a precedent for this kind of black market. In fact, Cuba has developed a lung cancer vaccine that has shown really promising results that have been published in a peer-reviewed journal in the United States. And the same, that vaccine, that lung cancer vaccine, is in phase three trials in the United States with a research group in New York. But even before then, Americans with lung cancer were traveling to Cuba and bringing back the vaccine in their luggage. And so, you know, this would not be without precedent. And again, you know, if the Cuban government is able to do it in a formalized way, I think that it could be a boost to the economy.
Briefly, Natalie.
Lewis, I think one of the big questions is to what extent does this particular Cuban virus have to require what they call the cold chain, you know, the refrigeration requirements. That I think that's a big question hovering over this idea that you can just come back and forth to get it.
Yeah, you have to keep this very, very cold. You can't put this in your freezer. I'm trying to understand this. Natalie,
let me... It requires basic refrigeration, this one. It doesn't require sub-zero.
Okay. Right. Okay.
So it's a bit easier. But I mean, I think that the point still stands, of course. I mean, in the case of the lung cancer vaccine, they were bringing it back in little refrigerated lunch boxes. So, of course, for all of us who are watching this all play out, the idea of coronavirus vaccines being transported in refrigerated lunch boxes is just... It's amazing to even consider.
I'm not laughing. I'm laughing because that does sound ridiculous, but this is a serious, it's a serious issue, but yeah, I don't know. Anyway, great way to end it. We'll leave it on that point. New York Times reporter, Natalie Kitroeff, and again, WLRN America correspondent, Tim Padgett. Natalie, Tim, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis.
And by the way, I just wanted to mention that like topics like this, if you have something you want to say about it, you have some comment, you can always stay in touch with us. Join our Sundial text club. Just text us the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. We'd like to hear what you think. Still to come, some consider it an insult, others embrace the idea. Coming up, we're going to learn about what it means to be a chonga. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Black and Latina women are often framed as embodying excessive styles, like the chonga style. It's portrayed in the viral 2007 video, Chongalicious.
Hit it, chonga. All the time I come around, brothers break the neck. Always looking at me, staring at me, trying to disrespect. I'm just trying to say that I know they won't fight, because they know I got my nails 12 centimeters high. And I know you think it's sexy when I wear my pants tight, because my love
is... Nails, tight pants, hoop earrings, heavy makeup. These all come to mind when we discuss the Miami-based chonga culture. A new book titled Aesthetics of Excess explores how the bodies of women of color are racialized and at the same time are a source of cultural capital when appropriated by pop culture. We spoke with the author of the book, Jillian Hernandez. She's also the professor at the University of Florida.
When I am describing chongas to people who aren't from Miami, I feel an immense responsibility in that because on the one hand, I know that what I'm sharing is sort of like a stereotype, but it's also part of the culture, right? So I find like I'm always walking this line between explaining a culture to outsiders without, you know, making the people in the culture seem like they're other or less than. It is definitely a Miami thing, and it has relationships to other style culture. So on the West Coast, we have Chola culture. And so Chola culture is similar, but it has more connection to like gang life, you know, Mexican-American and Latinx sort of urban spaces. And Chola style has a little bit of a masculine twist on it that I don't think chonga culture has, but, you know, chongas are sort of part of a larger array of young, urban, working class Latina girl culture. And what I'm trying to do in my book is to say that style is an artistic innovation and a cultural innovation that's very important. There's a way in which that's very much trivialized, but chonga style has influenced contemporary art. It has influenced music, popular music. And so I think the intervention I'm trying to make is to say, let's not think of chongas as just like a funny topic to talk about or as a problem that we need to fix, but let's actually appreciate what they contribute to not only Latinx culture, but to popular culture and art in a broader sense.
I wanted to get to this. This is really interesting. You worked on this arts project for young women of color in partnership with the Museum of Contemporary Art, North Miami, and you dedicate this book to all of those women that you worked with there. What was the, tell me a little bit about that program. What was the purpose of that program?
The purpose of that program was to engage girls in making art and in expressing themselves, and to do that as a form of sharing their knowledge and feeling powerful. And it was myself and a group of women artists from the community, and we would go to different places throughout Miami. So we would go to the juvenile detention center, we would go to drug rehabilitation centers, we would go to after school programs too, educational enrichment programs, and we worked with thousands of girls throughout Miami to one, introduce them to the work of women artists that they weren't taught about in school, and to use those women artists as positive role models for them. Most of these women artists have overcome a lot of really intense life challenges. And so for us, it was important not only that they learn about women artists of color, but that they see that these women used art as a way to survive a lot of really difficult life circumstances and to thrive and to express themselves. You know, girls are often policed into being quiet or being small or like not taking up space. And so Women on the Rise was about, you know, take up space. We want to hear what you think. You have knowledge to contribute. And it was a beautiful project that I'm so grateful to have been a part of and created.
I wanted to ask you about this one time, right, that you had, there was a story you had about a young girl who came up to you and said that you looked like a Bratz doll.
Yeah, she compared me to a Bratz doll.
So, I mean, when you hear that, and if anybody hasn't seen that doll, I mean, it's a very specific, the you know, this was, I don't know if it's fair to say, like the anti-Barbie. It was a doll that was, you know, over-accentuated in like its look, its size of its head, and everything else.
Yes.
I mean, like when they say that to you, though, like how did that affect you? What did you think about that? What did that mean to you?
Yeah. So this was at the detention center, and it was not meant to be mean-spirited at all. That, you know, so first I want to say, like, it was just something funny. Like, Miss, you look like a Bratz doll, you know? We all thought it was really funny, right? Because I didn't think that I looked like a Bratz doll. So like you said, right, Bratz doll being sort of the antithesis of Barbie. So the Bratz have really big lips, really big eyes. You know, they're kind of very urban styled dolls, right? They're not sort of like the middle class, you know, white girl of Barbie. And, you know, it was fun to have a debate with the girls about whether or not I really looked like a Bratz doll. But I remember after leaving, like driving home and being like, do I really look like a Bratz doll? Like, that can't be right, you know? And there was a way in which I wanted to disidentify with that. I wanted to say like, oh no, like that's not me, because, you know, Bratz, and Bratz are very much hated by a lot of mothers and by a lot of feminists. They're seen as like not good role models for girls. And at that time, I subscribed to that. My daughter actually was like maybe 7 at the time, and she wanted Bratz dolls, and I wouldn't buy them for her. So for me, it was like, oh my God, like I wouldn't buy my daughter this doll, yet I'm being compared to one. Like, it was really disorienting. And I reflected on it a lot, because I then began to question, one, is there something wrong with that? And if there is, like, what is wrong with that? And two, it was a way in which I confronted how, even if I think that I don't look like a Bratz doll or that I don't look like a Latina stereotype, that doesn't mean that other people don't view me that way anyway. So for as much as I think I can control how other people perceive me through my dress or through my makeup, the ways in which Latina women are viewed as excessive goes beyond me, and it affects the ways in which I'm viewed regardless of what I may think about it and regardless of how I put myself together, right? I thought that I looked artsy. I thought that I looked cultured. I thought that I looked educated. And it was like, looking back, I'm like, yeah, no, I did look like a Bratz doll. And you know what? Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But it took me a while because growing up, you know, my mother was very strict with like what I wore, right? And you have to look a certain way so that you could be respected. And so for me, like, that really got to the heart of, I think, my investment in really challenging how we think about girls and empowerment and what we expect them to look like. Do we only expect empowered girls to look a certain way? Can we not see the girl with the hoop earrings and the heavy makeup as empowered?
I'm speaking with Jillian Hernandez. She's a professor at the University of Florida. And her book, Aesthetics of Excess, Hernandez explores the ways that Black and Latina bodies are racialized, while also being appropriated by the contemporary art scene. You can find a link to her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to ask you about, and this happened some years back, but you know, it went the video went viral, and I think it's when people started talking about the idea of chonga, you know, outside of, I guess, just the youth. A lot of people started talking about it. I'm obviously talking about the Chongalicious video.
Yes.
By the two Miami High School students. It was, I think, Mimi Davila and Laura DiLorenzo. And they really exposed that idea to a lot of folks.
Chongalicious definition, arch my eyebrows high. They always staring at my booty and my panty line. You could see me.
You argue that the video is a modern form of parody from Cuba. It's called Choteo. Tell us about the history of that and how it's continued today.
So Choteo is a form of comedy that dates back to the 19th century in Cuba. And it was very much a form of comedy that was aimed at making fun of people who seemed to want to be above their given station in life, right? So it was a way to make fun of, let's say, a poor man who wanted to wear a really fancy suit. It was a way to mock people who were drawing attention to themselves in ways that were seen as improper. And so it was very much embroiled in the politics of race and class in colonial Cuba. So Choteo was often directed towards mulatas or Afro-Cuban men in particular who would wear fancy clothes, right? And so for me, that was an interesting history to connect to Chongalicious, in that although Chongalicious on the one hand is a celebration of Chonga culture, it's also a mockery, not a mean-spirited mockery, but it is a mockery of them. They put they use Sharpie markers to do their eyeliner. They say that they buy their clothes at the flea market in a way that, like, if it's funny to buy your clothes at the flea market, right? So it was not mean-spirited at all. But for me, it was a form of choteo in that it made it like, oh, you know, chongas, like, you all are so funny. Like, you're so funny. We can laugh at you. And if we can laugh at you, we don't need to feel discomfort with the different ways that you perform gender. Because to me, that gets to the core of why the chonga is a figure that fascinates us. Even as we might make fun of her, why are we so fascinated with her, right? Chongalicious has millions of views. The song played on Power 96. The Chonga girls, Mimi Davila and Laura DiLorenzo, are still making videos about Chongas. So there's a longstanding fascination with them. And I think it's because Chongas do not follow the rules, right? They're young women who don't care about the rules of what a good girl looks like or what a good girl acts like.
What do you think then about the, you know, the I guess this style, this excess style, and how it's almost kind, I mean, we can debate it, but I think it's become a little bit mainstream, right? Because look at, for example, Cardi B embracing that style. And then you go to Instagram and you see lots of people posting up pics of, and not necessarily chonga people, but just the style, the big hoops, the gold, the lip liner, all this stuff. So is it, have they accepted it? Has it become mainstream? Does that take something away from it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is slowly becoming mainstream, and I think that's a good thing. in that I'm glad to see women of color like Cardi B or like Megan Thee Stallion, because my book also talks about Black women and girls too. I write about Nicki Minaj in my book too. I'm glad to see that they are able to create work and to make a lot of money with the aesthetics of excess, especially because one thing I know in my book is that oftentimes, you know, young women of color are vilified, punished, demonized for having these styles of excess. But when like Miley Cyrus or Taylor Swift or another, you know, popular culture performer or like Lana Del Rey decide that they want to use these aesthetics, they're able to kind of take that on and off and not suffer the social consequences of that. So I'm actually quite excited to see that we may be moving into a realm in which these styles are respected, and in which the women who embrace these styles can actually, you know, be entrepreneurs and make money from it.
That was Jillian Hernandez. She's a professor at the University of Florida, and she recently published a book titled Aesthetics of Excess. It explores the ways that Black and Latina bodies are racialized while also being appropriated by the contemporary art scene. You can find photos and links to Hernandez's work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's our program for this Tuesday, February 23rd. Coming up tomorrow on the show, what role did professional sports play in early Miami as a tool for social justice and racial integration? We're going to hear from the author of The Miami Times and The Fight for Equality about its critical part of South Florida's history. And by the way, a reminder that we are reading Swamplandia by Karen Russell for this month for the Sundial Book Club. You can always find a copy on our, you can always find more on Sundial's Book Club on our Facebook page. Just look up Sundial Book Club. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.